It's always a good idea to have a lecture.
Your memory's pretty good, but not that good.
Yes, well, I've been sick. Okay.
Been out to lunch.
Out to lunch. This is Observations Concerning Faith in Hebrews, Lecture 43.
Yes.
Now, before we get into it, you will notice that I have left you all a blurb to have a look at. It's important that you do. I've got three items here out of hundreds that I could have downloaded on the printer, but item one is a 2,000-year-old electric battery from ancient Baghdad.
Wow.
It's 6 inches in height, housing a cylinder of sheet copper. Now, this is 2,000 years old, okay?
Yeah.
Right. The edge of the cylinder had been soldered with a lead-tin alloy, as it would be even today. The base of the cylinder is capped with copper discs and sealed with asphalt. The top is sealed with bitumen and was used to hold in place iron rods suspended into the centre of the copper cylinder. The rods showed evidence of having been corroded by an acid solution, long since evaporated. It would produce up to 2 volts of electricity, establishing without doubt that the ancients were far more advanced in respect of technology than we have understood until now. Okay? You're wondering why I'm showing you these things. Well, have a look at item two and see the depiction of a massive light globe in the temple of the goddess Hathor at Dendera in Egypt. Note the socket at one end and a cable travelling underneath with a snake-like filament inside. It's fascinating. I couldn't get a larger reproduction. Only about 2.5 or 3 inch by two. But if you have a good look at that, you'll see that it's pretty amazing. And item three, this is a 3,000-year-old hieroglyphs found in Seti I's temple in Abydos, Egypt, depicting nothing less than a helicopter, a plane, and futuristic aircraft. Have a good look at that.
Yes,
now, these are not fraudulent. These are absolute realities. But with reality, with the uncovering of these strange anomalies, you also get people who are out to confuse the issue. And I'll share these with you. This is supposed to be a 4,000 or 5,000-year-old iPhone with hieroglyphic buttons. And even though the British and Europeans thought, wonderful, look at this, it's fraudulent. It's absolutely fraudulent,
yeah.
But what they do is when they find these out of place artifacts that they don't want people to know about, they issue something so stupid, but looking realistic, to take our minds off an embarrassing thing. Yes, exactly, to discredit it. So, bearing that in mind, if you'd like to turn to Hebrews 11 and verse 7. Hebrews 11 and verse 7. Actuated by faith, Noah, or Noah, if you wish, having been divinely warned concerning impending events, when as yet there was no visible sign, with reverential care prepared an ark. In Hebrew, a teva, for the preservation of his household, by means of which faith he condemned the world and became an heir of the righteousness which is according to faith. It's rather interesting, in my view, that our faith condemns the world because they don't have any. Those who will get through the horror that's descending are those who have faith. We're going to talk a little bit today about the world in which Noah lived. And I wanted to approach it from a point of view that was totally unique, that no one else has ever gone to. And you might think, well, this is a challenge. Yes, it is. And I hope I succeed. So, before we concentrate our attention specifically on Noah in this series on faith, I'd like to share some very intriguing information concerning the gradually developing science of genetics, particularly in respect to atavistic throwbacks. We've all known people who have experienced a strange throwback in their genetic line. I'll come to that in a second and explain what I mean. But if you're looking for a definition of a throwback, genetic throwback, an atavistic throwback, it's, quote, modification of a biological structure whereby an ancestral genetic trait reappears after having been lost through evolutionary change in previous generations, unquote. So that's what that is, a trait that the ancients had, which suddenly reappears after hundreds of years, thousands of years, and as evolutionary theory would have it, millions of years ago. So I believe the scroll of Genesis may be able to appropriately interpret in respect of gills, and you're thinking, gills? What's this? Which are apparent in the very early fetal development in utero, in the uterus, but which tend to disappear entirely long before birth. Having said this, gills may appear in rare instances on the cheeks or the necks of newborns. It's pretty horrific, but I knew a midwife and I went to a birth once, and a little baby boy was born, and on his neck was a beautiful set of gills. Okay, so it happens. So arguments for and against the thought that humans can be born with vestigial gills are legion, but the fact is there are babies who are born with gills. Even though they are invariably non-functional and certainly undeveloped. They're just there. Such infants do exist. In fetal development in the uterus, gills are normal. In fact, if you look at
babies.
But they normally disappear in the vast majority of cases long prior to the final stages of pregnancy. It's a puzzle that keeps some obstetrician gynecologists rigidly on their toes, seeking answers to this mysterious biological process and non-developmental reality. You know, it's almost like, doctor, what do I do with this? But how do you explain this? My baby's perfect, except it's got gills. You know, I didn't give birth to a fish. What is this? But it happens. And it must send some gynos into a bit of a spin.
I'd send mother
into a spin. And not just humans can possess this startling anomaly. Allow me to make an observation about vestigial gills. These are physical organs, for want of a better descriptor, which are present on the body in a reduced form and which do not permit or perform any known function. They're just there. They are vestigial in the sense of remnants of organs that were once developed, well developed, in our ancestors. So what on earth, question is, what on earth were our ancestors doing with gills? That's the question. And no one can properly answer it except evolutionists who say it's a throwback to when we came out of the sea, okay? All right. Without doubt, the human parathyroid gland, you know the parathyroid gland, we've all got that, was once our gills. Our calcium levels are regulated by the parathyroid gland that secretes a parathyroid hormone if the calcium formation in the blood falls too low. So this hormone causes the release of calcium from bone and increases its intake by the kidney, raising the calcium levels back to normal. Now, Frank Joseph wrote a wonderful book in 2013 entitled Before Atlantis, 20 Million Years of Human and Pre-Human Cultures. And I found this book, it was for sale, and it was 2013, and page 18, I really thought, this is fascinating. He says, only since 2004, that's a few years ago, have scientists known that the parathyroid gland evolved from gills when our ancestors made the transition from an aquatic to a terrestrial environment. He's an evolutionist, so you've got to take his consideration seriously. Like syndactyly and subcutaneous fat, evolution of ancestral gills into the parathyroid gland is another telltale sign of our prolonged and formative interlude in the water. Well, that's what he says. In 1975, in the disappearing jungles of Cambodia, a rotting carcass of a deer equipped with gills was obtained by a noted zoologist, Dr. Walden Pond, from a Khmer Rouge commander who had retrieved it as a curiosity. It was identified as a very rare semi-aquatic antelope, Cetiformia anthalopus. The preserved remains are exhibited at the Berkeley Museum of Natural History by appointment only, with the Director of Special Collections, Dr. Stephanie Alderton. Modern sightings of this antelope are indeed rare, but not unprecedented. So we're facing a rather challenging observation. Humans, as embryos, fetal embryos, all have gills, all of them. Then they lose them. And it evolves into, or turns into, the parathyroid gland. The very fact that gills are found also on animals indicates that at one time, well, it seems to establish evolutionary theory in a positive way. We came out of the oceans, all right? That's how
Atlantis was real.
Oh, Atlantis was real. We'll come to that later. But modern sightings are rare of this particular antelope, but not unprecedented. But I think there's another answer to this. Whatever the case, there exist intelligent hypotheses related to evolutionary processes attempting to link the rise of Earth-grounded humanity as having been extracted originally from the oceans, and we are confidently informed that these gills are throwbacks to our apparent aquatic stage of our evolution. While this is an interesting hypothesis, there may be an alternative view that merits thoughtful and biblical consideration. What do you reckon, Laura?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. Well, I would suggest that those who espouse these interesting but largely speculative theories are accomplishing little more than chasing elusive rainbows. Before I make my own suggestion, which some people will accept and some people will laugh their heads off, consider these startling reality checks. Some white women have given birth to black babies. And you might go, oh, yeah, a bit promiscuous. No. Without any exposure even to the black race. My family knew a lady who gave birth to a black baby and nearly ended in divorce.
I bet, yeah.
Until they did an ancestral check, and about five generations previous, there had been a black man in the family.
African.
And out it came all those generations later. I don't know, I can't recall whatever happened to the marriage, whether it was brought back to normalcy or not. I can't comment on it. But certainly somewhere in some time in the past, in their genetic ancestry, there's been sexual activity between the races. That's how it happens. That's a throwback. Mm-hmm. Again, there are birds, chickens and others, who are born with teeth. That's a fact. It's rare, but it does happen.
Rare as hen's teeth.
Rare as hen's teeth.
Yeah.
There it is.
Yeah.
Dew claws. They absolutely serve no purpose. Dew claws are found on dogs and are more of a nuisance than anything, especially when they rip and you've got to get it to the vet. But hind limbs are found on dolphins, whales and other sea creatures. You know, we know they don't have limbs. Well, some do. Why? Extra toes can be located on the modern horse and on guinea pigs. Reappearance of wings on wingless stick and leaf insects are a fact. Extra nipples on both male and female bodies occur. In fact, one of my ancestors, the infamous Countess of Pembroke and Queen of England, Anne Boleyn, possessed three breasts, which made King Henry VIII very satisfied indeed, at least for a time. Propensity for interest in women. Human tails on early fetal embryos, which soon disappear. Occasionally, babies actually born with the tail intact are subject to surgery within a short amount of time. Okay. Another reality check occurs when human infants are placed in water and suddenly swim. Infants from birth to 6 months are innate swimmers and they also possess a very natural diving reflex. No learning needed, no instruction given, it comes natural to them, they are natural born swimmers. And in fact, when the home birth movement started in Australia, the Laboyer method that it evolved into birth in water, and the baby would be born in water and it would just swim around until they got it and put it on the mother's breast and cut the cord.
It happens a lot today too.
Yes, that's exactly right. In the uterus, and this is important to remember, in the uterus all human babies develop webbed fingers and toes as well as gills. So not just gills, but webbed fingers, webbed toes. Obviously, an embryo and fetus is fed directly from its mother via the placenta. It has no need of gills. An unborn baby does not breathe until it is born. Webbed fingers and toes are later subjected to necessary surgery. Webs of skin between the toes occurs among 7% of humans, one in every 2,000 to 3,000 live births. An early 20th century examination of 1,000 school children found webbing between the second and third toes in 9% of boys and 7% of girls. Webbing between all toes took place, but was represented by smaller percentages. So, as I was going through that volume I mentioned a minute ago by Frank Joseph, I found a quotation which stunned me. He says, quote, "Writing in Proceedings of the Natural Academy of Sciences, Professor Anthony Graham and Dr. Masataka Okabe speculated that the transformation from gills to parathyroid gland occurred many millions of years ago, during life's transition from the sea to the land. But evolution concerning transition from an organ, particularly with the persistence of such visible traces of its former function and configuration, suggests a far more recent aquatic past." Now, it was this quote that especially caught my eye. As I've done many times in the past, I gave more thought to what it was really like in the days of Noah, and especially what it was like prior to the deluge, which was not a local event, it was worldwide in its impact. Now, I want to talk a little bit, having said all that as an intro, what we think we know about the antediluvian world. What we think we know. Because if we are true students of the Word of God, we are always open to new ideas, new views, so that we can better grasp the truth of that God's trying to convey by the Holy Spirit. If you look at Genesis 2, verse 6, Genesis 2 and verse 6, we read, "There went up a mist from the earth and watered the whole face of the ground." So we know our planet's atmosphere at this time was different, because that's not happening today. And if you look at Genesis chapter 9, verse 1 and 2, after the flood, of course, It says, God blessed Noah and his sons and said to them, be fruitful and multiply and replenish the earth. And the fear of you and the dread of you shall be upon every beast of the earth and upon every fowl of the air, except for magpies and butcher birds, which my wife feeds. Upon all that move upon the earth and upon all the fishes of the sea. Into your hand are they delivered. So not only was the planet's atmosphere different at that time to now, nature was also obviously different. Obviously. There are scientists who believe in the biblical revelation who inform us that the sky was probably a shade of red rather than our usual daily experience of blue hue. They'd go outside their house and they'd see a beautiful red sky and they'd say, oh, this is normal, this is good. Genesis speaks of certain people who lived extraordinarily extensive lengths of lives before their deaths, a few of which almost got to 1,000 years. Histories contained in religious literature of other ancient nations and races make frequent mention of astonishing length of life. So it's not just the Bible that does this. We also know from the record of Genesis and from ancient non-biblical legends and mythologies that cannibalistic warlike giants roamed the earth in those days and also after that. If you look at Genesis 6:4, it mentions they were in the earth before the flood, then they were in the earth after the flood. Of course, medical textbooks inform us of gigantism, because that's what we're dealing with, is an abnormal growth caused essentially by an excess of growth hormone, GH, in childhood, usually due to a dysfunction of the pituitary gland. That's true, but there are other reasons for gigantic growth. Specialists in evolutionary theory reliably inform us that during the Carboniferous and Permian epochs, our planet's air contained 31 to 35% oxygen as compared to just 21% oxygen in Earth's air today. So there was a huge amount of oxygen available in the antediluvian world. As a consequence of more oxygen, insects were much larger than we have around us today. Mosquitoes were up to 2 feet in length. Yeah. We've got little mosquitoes. Like
carrying them away.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
At least you could see them coming.
Yes. And of course, dinosaurs.
Imagine the size of your swat.
Look how big. Look at the size of dinosaurs. Absolutely. Look at the size they got. So, but still another theory, back in the first half of the 20th century and now recently revived, involves the effect of the moon's gravitational pull on the Earth and on human beings if there were two moons surrounding us. That would cause gigantism. This is intriguing. This may not seem to be as stupid as some people may think. Scientists are admitting that there may well be an undetected moon in our solar system that has in the past engaged with our planet, and certain legends are associated with such a happening.
Right.
Absolutely. Turn to Isaiah 60 and verse 20. Isaiah 60 and verse 20. Again, I've tried to make this lecture today as interesting as I possibly could. I don't think I will fail. We'll see. Isaiah 60 and verse 20 states, your sun shall no more go down, neither shall your moon withdraw itself, for Yehovah shall be your everlasting light, and the days of your mourning shall be ended. So it seems to say that at the end of the age, that there will be two moons caught on Earth's orbit as Earth's satellites. And you might say, well, where's that? Mm. Well, the word moon in Hebrew is moons.
That's plural.
Plural. Now, some messianic Bibles use the word months, but that's a terrible irregularity in the text. It's not months, it's moons. So at the end of days, expect another moon. not just
one
around.
Yeah.
So, but there's also an ancient text in the Torah suggesting that way back in the second millennium BCE, which is the age of gravel, when Israel began its real history, our planet captured a second moon. I'll talk about that in a second. And it presumably circled the Earth for some generations until it was finally jettisoned from our orbit for some reason. But the moon plays a major part in influencing matters on Earth, from the planting of crops to the birth of children. Yet the place of the moon in the affairs of humankind would have changed considerably over the centuries due to the fact that we once possessed not one, but two moons circling in a rotating motion around our Earth. Turn over to Deuteronomy 33:14. Deuteronomy, Devarim. 33:14. Yes. Verse 14. this is a blessing from Joseph, and he says, be blessed for the precious fruits brought forth by the sun and for the precious things put forth by the moon. The moon is plural in Hebrew here. So it indicates back in the age of gravel there would be another moon. There are two moons at least.
No, I've got months.
No. Yeah, months is not right.
Is it Deuteronomy?
Deuteronomy 33:14. Some Gentile scholars would like to so erroneously transliterate it as months, but it's not months, it's moons in the Hebrew. And when you put it together with Isaiah 60 verse 20, we realise he's talking about the very end of time, and indeed that is what is yet to come.
So that word, the last word, months...
It should be moons, plural. So neither of these verses refer to months. But again, it doesn't make sense to these transliterators because they go, well, no, we've only got one moon. This must be months. Well, no, it means moons. There's going to be two moons, as there was in the early days of Genesis, before the flood of Noah. So the moon plays a major part in influencing matters on Earth. But I want you to turn over to Job. It would certainly explain gigantism if there are two moons. One of my favourite verses in the whole Bible is Job chapter 8, verse 8 and 9. Job 8, verse 8 and 9. For inquire, I pray thee, of the former age, and prepare thyself to the search of their fathers, for we are but of yesterday, and we know nothing, because our days upon earth are a shadow. Indeed they are. But when I was originally called to this ministry, that was pointed out to me as, after I had prayed and said, you know, what do you want from me, Lord? And he gave me Job 8:8-9. Prepare yourself to the search of your fathers. Do it. And that's what my whole life's been about. Researching, getting into ancient texts, not just of the biblical revelation, but from all religions. I've done this. I've done my job doing that. Historian Will Durant noted, immense volumes have been written to expound our knowledge and conceal our ignorance. I like that. Of primitive man. Primitive cultures were not necessarily the ancestors of our own. For all we know, they may be the degenerate remnants of higher cultures that decayed when human leadership moved in the wake of the receding ice age. And how true is that? There's more than one way of looking at the past.
Yeah.
He went on to add, we cannot properly estimate the achievements of prehistoric man. We suspect that time has destroyed remains that would narrow the gap between primeval and modern man. Will Durant? Correct. Physicist Frederick Soddy, I don't know where the name Soddy comes from, but anyway, he was a physicist, and in 1909 he wrote a book called Interpretation of Radium. Now, this is what he wrote. Can we not read in ancient records some justification for the belief that some former forgotten race of men attained not only to the knowledge we have so recently won, but also to the power that is not yet ours. I believe that there have been civilizations in the past that were familiar with atomic energy and that by misusing it, they were totally destroyed. Ah, yes, that quote is absolutely correct and it was written in 1909, before the atom bomb, before any of Einstein's theories came to fruition.
Wow.
That's in his book, Interpretation of Radium.
Gee.
Biologist and zoologist and head of the Society for the Investigation of the Unexplained, Ivan Sanderson, has said, "The concrete evidence that the ancients knew of flight was forced upon us only a few years ago. Now we have to explain it." Ah, yes. Now we have to explain it. And when we do, we will have to rearrange a great many of our concepts of ancient history. Amen. Truly. Man was capable of an intense scientific advancement way back at the Tower of Babel, which was the period just after the flood. A period in living memory of the deluge, and God was so concerned about man's achievements that he dispersed the nations and gave them diverse languages. But what is often overlooked is why God did that. Look at Genesis 11 and verse 6. Genesis 11 and verse 6. Yehovah said, "Behold, the people is united as one, and they have all one language. And this they begin to do." Yeah, build this tower. This is what they begin to do. And then he says, "And now nothing will be restrained from them, which they have imagined to do." So how advanced had humanity become during the Nimrod epoch? The Lord himself had to hold men and women back in order to restrain humankind from accomplishing an utter cosmocide. A good place to start was to confound language. Now you might say, well, why did that happen? Well, you know, non-biblical historical texts reveal that this confusion of languages was God's signal for Shem, who was the son of Noah, to attack the, at that time, divided Babylonian kingdom of Nimrod with shock weapons that are described in ancient texts as little less than awesome. No bows and arrows. He went in there with sonic beams. And when you read these texts, particularly in the Mahabharata and other writings of the Hindus, you find descriptions that can only be referring to nuclear capability. Because, when canaries turn white 20 miles away in their cages and people were dropping dead with no apparent cause as radiation went through. A warfare of horrific dimensions ensued, destroying much of the human race and vitrifying entire regions around the globe so that they shone like glass. And even now, you've got scientists are going around to these areas of Africa and India and Afghanistan and places like that, and the whole area for miles is glass, showing some incredible, powerful nuke that took it all out. Ecclesiastes 1 verse 9, Solomon mused, "There is nothing new under the sun. That which is has been already." this is the attitude, this is the mindscape God has given me. He gave it way back about 1967. And since then, I've been intrigued by ancient history. In fact, I have a very, very rare copy of the Egyptian Book of the Dead on my shelf. And it's rather interesting. I'll talk about that in a second. But the results of the deluge brought humankind into early contact with higher, technologically advanced humanoids who gladly opened Pandora's box for them. And that's what we're facing today. There's a whole surge of UFO activity all around the world.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it's no longer a secret.
It's no longer a secret. And so it was during the Age of Babel that the Egyptian Book of the Dead referred to man's contact with, quote, "the shining ones who live in rays of light," unquote. And it includes eerie statements such as, quote, "I course through space and time," unquote, and repeated mention of legions in the sky associated with, quote, unquote, "winged discs." We're looking at that now. We see it now. It's all around us. One man said to me once, "Well, I haven't seen anything. I don't see anything in the sky." I said, "How often do you look up there?" the evolutionary scientists who believe that man evolved from two original lovesick ocean amoeba and has progressed from ape-like creatures scraping its knuckles along the ground to technological wizard taking millions of years to get here, are extremely hesitant to explain what they curiously refer to as ooparts. And as I've explained in the past, ooparts means out-of-place artifacts. They are historical items of interest, unearthed by the archaeologists Trowell and Spade, or located at impossible levels of geological strata that do not belong in the age in which they were discovered. They are modern items found in ancient substratum of Earth. And with those items that I've shown you today, that's just tipping the, that's the tip of the iceberg. Because that Baghdad battery, for instance, that's only one. But there are thousands of them in museums. 2,000 years old, 2,500 years old, 3,000 years old. They knew about electricity in the ancient days. People can laugh at that, but the fact is, go to the museum, have a look. Have a look. Whatever the case in relation to ooparts, evidence of such a worldwide catastrophe, referred to in the biblical revelation as Noah's flood, is found in the geological records and in the myths and legends of all peoples of the earth, from ancient Chaldea to the Polynesians to the Australian Aboriginals. Everybody has a story that goes way back in the past, and they are all connected in many points that they have in common. Number one, when you talk about the deluge, whether it's in the Bible or whether it's in Chaldea, Babylonia, Polynesia, wherever, a divine warning is given prior to the catastrophe. All right? They all have these things in common. Number two, rescue of the seeds of life by a ship, boat, or canoe. Even the Aboriginals have a dugout where there are eight people in the dugout and they've all got food that's going to carry over into the new world. Three, the description of the building of a ship suitable for the high seas. Number four, waters that cover mountains. I said cover, not necessarily submerge them, but they cover mountains. Five, on earth, a race of men is turned to clay. Yeah, of course they are. Number six, there's a mountain of rescue. Number seven, birds are set free from the ship to locate land. And number eight, a number of these stories carry the figure of eight survivors huddled in the ship. And nine, in a few of these myths, God is seen to have overshot his aim. Yes, it's sort of, oh no, what have I done? You know, in destroying the earth. And even the book of Genesis says that God repented of destroying humankind. He's overshot. It was like, I've got a clean house. So he cleans house and goes, oh no, actually, sorry that this has happened. But be that as it may, the planet was destroyed by water in a colossal disaster that left its imprint in the collective unconscious mind of humankind. The waters that were above the earth collapsed. I'll talk about that in a minute. The waters beneath the continents broke through the earth's crust, and massive tsunamis carried hundreds of thousands of enormous boulders from one continent to another. This is why in Scotland you will find huge boulders as big as this room here that are over in Iceland or over in North America. You sort of go, well, they originated in Scotland. What are they doing over here? What are they doing over there? What are they doing over there? Tsunamis carried them.
Yeah, shells on tops of mountains.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Balanced delicately in some cases. Yeah. So modern geologists scratch their heads at topographical puzzles and odd anomalies, but they all make sense when we believe the record in the book concerning which few scholars give any credence. And we've got it here. We are so fortunate, so blessed to be able to open that Bible and read what it says. But reading what it says is one thing. Believing what it says is quite another. Quite another. As to the anomaly of a far-reaching technology in existence in ancient times, apart from the occasional ooh-part surfacing, so we have to read between the lines of the biblical revelation to discover proof that humankind before the flood was in possession of crucial knowledge necessary for the development of civilization. You see, we as a race are in fact devolving, not evolving.
Mm-hmm.
Question. When we think of Noah's Ark, do we also wonder about waste disposal? You know, when we were little kids, we open up our little picture book and there's this house full of animals. And we don't think in terms of, well, you know, he's going to be in the ark for a year. Chuck it over. But there was one door in the ark and God closed it. Okay, waste disposal.
They needed nose pegs.
Nose peg, I reckon. Ventilation. There's a problem. Air conditioning. Oh, there's a big problem. Maintenance. Oh, yes, well, you know, it's a storm out there and this great ship is being rocked about all over the place. And lighting. Was it all black inside? Was it all dark? All you could do is hear the animals snorting and bellowing and neighing and whatever. That'd drive you nuts. Did they have earplugs? What's with this? We ought to consider giving some positive thoughts to these issues because Noah was on board the ark and with his family for 364 days. That's how total it was. People read the Bible, they go, 40 days it rained. Therefore, 40 days Noah was in the ark. No. Look at Genesis 8, verse 6 and 7. Genesis 8, verse 6 and 7. We read. So it came to pass at the end of 40 days that Noah opened the window of the ark which he had made, and he sent out a raven, which flew here and there until the waters were dried up from the earth. The 40 days mentioned in Genesis 8, 6 and 7, if we examine these days carefully, occurs subsequent to the visibility of the surrounding mountain peaks as the flood begins to subside. Because look at verse 5, and always look at the context of what you're studying. Always look at the context. In verse 5 we read, and the waters decreased continually until the 10th month. In the 10th month, on the first day of the month, the tops of the mountains were seen. Once they were seen, he, after 40 days, opens a window of the ark, sends out the raven. By looking at the context, the mountaintops became visible, but this was after 7 months from the start of the Diluvian catastrophe. Right up to the 10th month when this 40-day period began. Yeah, so he opened a window. Well, that's good. When is a window not a window?
When it's shut.
Still a window. It may be a shut window, but it's still a window. Noah opened up in the ark a window in order to send forth a raven to locate dry earth. It was a continual exercise in futility until one day the raven failed to return. So he sends forth a dove. Why the change? Why didn't he send out another raven? Why didn't he send out another, you know, why did he send out a raven in the first place and not a dove?
Because doves are cleverer than ravens.
No, they eat different things. A raven eats carrion. So it had plenty of decaying flesh floating about on which to devour to its satisfaction. This is why it failed to return to the ark. So Noah realizes his error and sends forth a dove. In verse 8 of Genesis 8 we read, then he sent forth a dove from him to see if the waters had subsided from the face of the ground. But the dove found no place to set her foot, and she returned to him to the ark, for the waters were still on the face of the whole earth. So he put out his hand and took her and brought her into the ark with him. The dove returned without finding anywhere suitable for its ongoing habitation. But just 7 days later, the dove sent out again and brings back evidence of a return to a habitual or habitable normal. Verse 10 of chapter 8 says, he waited another 7 days and again sent forth the dove out of the ark. And the dove came back to him in the evening, and in her mouth was a freshly plucked olive leaf. So Noah knew the waters had subsided from the earth. After another week, Noah sent forth a dove. This time she failed to return to the ark. That's in verse 12. Noah realized humankind was finally ready and prepared to exit the great vessel. Noah knew his waiting period within the vessel was well and truly over. And what was the first thing he did when he got out of the ark?
He kissed the ground.
No.
He said, I need a drink. He removed
the drink. He did later. But no, the very first thing.
Removed the covering from the altar.
He built an altar.
That's exactly right. He built an altar. Now, if you have a look at Genesis 8, verse 6 and 7, which we have read, it talks about a window out of which the raven and the dove flew. Now, the Hebrew for the window is chalon, with a little A on the end if you want to be Sephardic and go chalona. That's window. And it obviously means an opening. But go back to Genesis 6, verse 16, and this is where it's interesting. Genesis chapter 6 and verse 16, God commands his servant to make a zohar in the ark. And it's translated, usually, window. So this word has confused translators and other scholars. Some think it's a word intending a roof. The New Revised Standard Version says roof. Orthodox Jewish Bible, that's Messianic, it says roof. Christian Standard Bible, roof. Common English Bible, roof. English Standard Version, roof. Holman, Lexham, New Catholic Bible, etc., roof. Well, what's that?
I said he had himself a skylight.
A skylight. Actually, you're getting close to it. In the vast majority of translations and versions, including the Geneva Bible, it simply is another window. In contradistinction, the American Standard Version and the brilliant 19th century biblical scholar J.N. Darby, in his translation, rightly speaks of it as a light in the ceiling, a light.
The light of, what's that called, Mary? The light of
Elendil.
So have a look at Genesis 6, verse 16. And this is, in Genesis 6, 16, this is how J.N. Darby translates it. He says, a light shall you make to the ark, and to a cubit high shall you finish it above. A light. But again, most translations and versions have either window or roof.
Yeah, I've got window.
But it's a light. That is something that will light up the ship. It's decidedly not a window. It's not an opening, no matter how many Christian authorities proclaim it to be so. The Hebrew word is not chalom, it is zohar. T-Z-O-H-A-R, then transliterated from the Hebrew. This word is mentioned 22 times in the Hebrew scriptures, and in every text so used it means, quote, a brightness, a brilliance, the light of the noonday sun, unquote, with its cognates, referring to something that glistens or shines. In fact, the Zohar, Z-O-H-A-R, spelled slightly differently to T-Z-O-H-A-R, but it means the same, of the mystical Kabbalah means splendor or radiant light, which enlightens the heart of man. So we're talking about an actual light.
Mm.
It's a light. We're realizing that the ancients knew of electricity. I've already shown you a 2,000-year-old electric battery, and we've seen that. We get further hints about the use of this power when you gaze at wonderment at an Egyptian carving, which displays an Egyptian utilizing an enormous globe that radiates light throughout the tomb. That was item two.
Mm.
Interestingly enough, when early tombs and pyramid chambers with deep tunnel systems were originally explored, there was no evidence of candle grease or soot. No, they didn't come down there with candles. They used electricity. We go, no! Oh, wait a minute. Evolutionary theory is dominating us. It's a theory.
Mm.
Let's remember that. Clearly, the creators of these perfectly squared tunnel systems, and they are perfectly squared. They're not carved out like some madman trying to dig a hole down there. No, they're perfectly and tiled and all of that. The creators of these perfectly squared tunnel systems utilized something other than candles or burning torches to see where they were going. And that picture of that huge globe is interesting. Scholar René Neuerbergen suggests, quote, Noah's light seems to have been preserved in history for hundreds of years. for we find indications that King Solomon of Israel may have used it about 1000 BCE. An ancient Jewish manuscript entitled The Queen of Sheba and Her Only Son Menelech, translated by Sir E. A. Wallace Budge, contains this statement, quote, "Now the house of Solomon the king was illuminated as by day, for in his wisdom," in his understanding of science, "he had made shining pearls which were like unto the sun, the moon, and the stars in the roof of his house."
Party lights.
Party lights, there you go. And he had a party of a life, that bloke.
Didn't he ever?
Norbergen challenges our modern atheistic views of the past with these comments. What makes the pre-flood electricity tradition so exciting and intriguing is that the early patriarch Canaan was a craftsman, the inventor of many crafts. According to an ideal Bible chronology, he died around 3819 BC, which means he lived for nearly a century following Tubal-Cain's discovery of the art of metallurgy. In keeping with his craftsmanship, Canaan, in the crowning years of his life, may have combined Tubal-Cain's knowledge of the properties of metals with his own ingenuity and become the first man to discover and utilize the power of electricity. This certainly is not an illogical assumption when we have evidence that electricity was used after the flood by craftsmen, the gold and the silversmiths of Babylonia and Persia.
Well, they weren't solar panels, were they?
That's exactly. Not made in China. René Neuberger, Secrets of the Lost Races, New Discoveries of Advanced Technology in Ancient Civilizations, 1977, page 46. Again, Noah was required by the Lord Yehovah to make the ark waterproof. Pitch. Remember that?
Yes.
Put pitch on here. Okay. He had to cover the boat inside and outside with something called pitch, Genesis 6:14. The Hebrew for pitch is chofer, bitumen or asphalt. We are reminded asphalt is a petroleum product formed by vegetable and animal remains that was subjected to tremendous heat and pressure. The creationist geologists believe this occurred when antediluvian life forms were buried by the flood. Yet the Genesis account clearly states that Noah was to waterproof the ark with asphalt, which raises the question, was a petroleum product such as asphalt in evidence before the flood?
One of our sons spoke to me about that theory, which is now being debunked, that they don't think that that's how that sediment was laid down at all, that it's something that is just natural to the Earth's inner sphere, that has got really nothing whatsoever to do with.
Yes, that's the latest theory now, which I tend to agree with. I'm just quoting René Neuberger on that. But yes, that is another way of looking at it. Or it could not have been necessarily Noah's flood, but rather, which it had, couldn't have been, because Noah had to have asphalt available to him.
That's right.
Which they had,
yeah, back further.
That's right. Because there was an original destruction, which I spent a lot of time on in Genesis 11, verse 1 and 2, which talked about the original destruction of the earth when dinosaurs were all destroyed and so on and so forth. So it could have come from there. Or it could quite possibly have come from the fact that God made the earth the way he did, with that as a residue within.
They're going to really like this stuff in the 20th
Pardon?
Century.
Sorry?
They're going to really like this stuff in the
20th
century.
Yeah. Indeed.
Sodom and Gomorrah, were there tar pits there in that land too?
Well, that's a good question. I wouldn't think so.
I think that study that
was fire and brimstone, yeah.
Mm. The latest theory on that one is that there was an actual comet that went past, or an asteroid, small asteroid, which exploded over the area and wiped it all out, clean as a whistle. Because there's a lot of area there.
It's still only a theory.
It's still a theory, yeah, I know. Mm. Well, was asphalt in evidence before the flood? Norbergen says it must have been, since it did not happen naturally, we must assume it was produced artificially. This presupposes a highly advanced knowledge of chemistry, particularly in the area of hydrocarbons. If the antediluvians were knowledgeable in hydrocarbon chemistry and production, then the entire range of petroleum products was within their grasp, from waterproof sealants, the pitch of the ark, to plastics and other synthetic materials. Most important, however, they would have been able to produce machine lubricants and engine fuel. So this puts a whole new perspective on this primitive, quote-unquote, Ark of Noah. They weren't so stupid after all. And he adds, it is no mere chance that the root word of chemistry, chemia, is attributed to Chem, K-A-G-M, the ancient name for the land of Egypt, or the land of Chem, derived from the biblical Ham, one of the three sons of Noah. And I would say amen to that.
See, we're not so modern after all, are we?
No, we're not.
Nothing new.
But for those who are listening around Australia and America and elsewhere, for those of our students who wish to expand the parameters of their mental acumen or their ignorance, may I recommend they obtain a copy of Netherlands scholar René Neurbergen's compacted little volume, Secrets of the Lost Races, New Discoveries of Advanced Technology in Ancient Civilizations, which is still available through online booksellers and really is a must-have requirement as a means of further industrious study. I would also suggest the author Andrew Thomas, T-O-M-A-S, especially his book, We Are Not the First, Riddles of Ancient Science, 1973, which is now valued at $450 in paperback, and I have on my shelf and have had since about 1973. So I don't need to go out and buy it, I've already got it. The world is full of mysteries, but some can be solved by returning to and exploring in an in-depth way the biblical narrative. In its turn, there exist multiple mysteries in the Bible too. Indeed, books penned about Enoch can sometimes be confusing to people who are interested in studying ancient historical matters in the biblical narratives. There have been writers who have confused the existence of Cain's eldest son Enoch, Genesis 4 verse 17, with the son of Jared, Genesis 5, 21. They both have the name Enoch, and the father of Methuselah, the son of Cain, who possesses the same identical name as the man whom God favoured so highly, was named for a city which Cain early built, Genesis 4, verse 18. As for the progeny of Jared, certainly the name Enoch, or Hanok in Hebrew, carries the meaning devoted, dedicated, initiator. But it also means initiated into secret or mystical knowledge, according to René Neurbergen. Do you want that light on?
Yes, do you?
It's getting a bit dark here. Thanks, Glennis. As we approach more closely the end of days and more knowledge about the ancient world gradually increases, particularly the period or aeon we would refer to as the antediluvian world, more and more enlightenment dawns on our grasp of the biblical revelation. The book of Genesis has a great deal of knowledge yet to be understood as the Ruach of God opens up our understanding. There exists an ancient prayer which I have used for well over 50 years. It goes like this. From the cowardice that shrinks from new truth, from the laziness that is content with half-truths, from the arrogance that thinks it knows all truth, O God of truth, deliver us.
Yes. Well said.
So what was it like in the days of Noah? That's the question on most of our lips. We have already considered some of the differences between today's world and the world of Noah before the deluge. Intriguingly, the first mentioned characteristics of the days of Noah are located plainly enough for all of us to see in Genesis 6, verse 1. And what does it say? It is written, it came to pass when humankind began to multiply on the earth and daughters were born to them. Yes, that's how it starts. Two interesting yet often overlooked facts about that ancient period. Number one, Genesis records a marked increase in population growth, followed by the mention of daughters born to them. Now, consider this. Firstly, our planet Earth is populated by around 8 billion souls. It's a lot of people. Specifically, January 1st, 2023, world population stood at 7,942,645,086, which was an increase of 73,772,634 people from New Year's Day 2022. In just 30 years from now, in 2050, at the present rate of growth, Earth will sustain 9.7 billion. To get our bearings a bit better, think about the fact that in 1950, and I was only 5 years of age at that time, the figure was only 2.5 billion. Scientists and others are scrambling to create various methods guaranteed to depopulate the planet. Not a pleasant truth to stare us all in the face, but the urgent need seen by many authorities to depopulate the planet is a fact that will not go away, though many of us may attempt to hide our faces from this reality. The COVID-19 plandemic, along with the unfortunate Clayton's COVID vaccine, was a trial run with the hope of resultant physical debilitation and depopulation. When I say Clayton's, this may not be familiar to people overseas. Mm-hmm. It's a vaccine you have when you don't have a vaccine. I don't know if people in the US or other parts of the globe have been exposed to Clayton's pretend whiskey on their supermarket shelves. It's bottled like whiskey. It looks like whiskey. It smells like whiskey. But it tastes like I would imagine deodorized kerosene would taste. It also costs about a fifth of the price of a bottle of cheap whiskey. All right? So when I use the term Clayton's, you all now know what I'm referring to. But secondly, what's with the supposed remarkable fact that females were born unto them? The answer may well be hinted at by our Lord Yeshua, who said, almost in passing, that the days of his anticipated second advent would parallel the days of the narration period. Matthew 24, verse 37 states, "As it was in the days of Noah, so shall it be in the days of the coming of the Son of Man." So, whatever is happening at the end of this age has already occurred way back thousands of years ago in the age of Noah. Can't get around that. Consider that at the end of the age, the prophet Isaiah predicted that women who today, at the conclusion of the age, possess material and financial independence, shall grab hold of a Jewish man and plead to become his wife, indicating the spectre of a frightening dearth of actual men on the earth. Isaiah 4 verse 1. Have a look at this, because it is most intriguing, because we often overlook this. You know, and daughters were born unto them. Oh, okay. How do we interpret that? Well, Isaiah tells us at the very end of the age, because he uses the term "in that day," and that's always a messianic phrase indicative of the conclusion of the present age. In that day, seven women will take hold of one man and say, "We will eat our own food, we will provide our own clothes, only let us be called by your name, take away our disgrace." Now that's coming. That's at the end of the age. That's when it's going to happen. Well, guess what? Rabbinic authorities speak of what it exactly was that carried the idea or impression of a disgrace back in Isaiah's day and age as consisting of being single, remaining unmarried, therefore denying the decree of God in the very beginning to be fruitful and multiply and replenish the earth by failure to give birth to a host of children to carry on the family name. That was the disgrace back then. No longer today, but that's what it was back then. Obviously, daughters were always born to humankind since the very dawn of time. So what was interesting about daughters being born to them? Well, it occurs when? At the time of extraordinary population growth on the earth. Ah, hang on a minute. Put the little grey cells into work here. Because, for whatever reason, there would be a shortage of men. Again, our
it's
end
30
of
the... 30 to 1 up on the Gold Coast.
30 to 1.
30 women to 1 man up on the Gold
there
Coast.
There you go. At the end of our age scenario, it is paralleling the days of Noah. Back then, there was a shortage of males, a veritable famine of men. Recall in our own time the 21st century Chinese population planning initiative, one child per family official policy, implemented between 1979 and 2015. Which brought about the wholesale murders of newborn daughters right across China. Horrendous. Shocking. Yeah.
Shocking.
Perhaps something of that nature in relation to male babies was a cause for the overabundance of women that reptilian sons of God, the Bani Elohim, sought after when they arrived suddenly and unannounced through the Stargate atop Mount Hermon in Syria. Whatever the case, Paul the Apostle confirmed that the end of the age would consist of wholesale masses of the population rejecting God, the existence of a rank pleasure-seeking narcissism, almost blind pursuit of materialism, dribbling at the mouth for immorality, luxuriating in negative idleness, watching the rise of unparalleled violence. It's all there, 2 Timothy 3, 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5. Star gods of the heavens, the Bene Elohim, were also monitoring the planet. That the planet was anciently filled to overflowing with violence in Noah's day is a reason why Jehovah God sent the deluge to destroy it. Genesis 6:13. He said, I've had enough. I'm pulling the plug. We are living our lives in unprecedented times, not witnessed since the days of Noah. You stick on Fox News, you stick on CNN, you hear unprecedented, unprecedented, unprecedented. This is unprecedented. Yeah. Even the pagans are understanding that it's unprecedented. Every day we hear or read or see evidence of the rising horror of violence all around us. You look in New York, don't stand at the edge of a platform. Some unhinged individual push you under the train as it's coming. That's what's going on. In the past 90 years, more people have been killed because of wars than during the previous 500 years combined. And just in the last 20th century, war destroyed the lives of 203 million people, according to Matthew White's Historical Atlas of the 20th Century. Apart from war, governments took the lives of 360 million souls in the 20th century alone. Your head can't get around this. More civilians have been dying in armed conflicts than combatants themselves, accounting for 90% of casualties since 1945. Just in the last decade, war has claimed the lives of an estimated 2 million children and disabled another 4 to 5 million children. A silent form of violence is perpetrated around the world by deliberate abortions of innocents. Each year, 44 million abortions are performed worldwide. That's according to 2008 global abortion rates. Globally, the National Consortium for the Study of Terrorism and Responses to Terrorism has documented more than 125,000 violent terrorist attacks since 1970. Martha Crenshaw, a board member, reported, sadly, it seems to be increasingly acceptable in certain belief systems to kill as many members of the other religious community as possible. Moral restraints seem to be eroding. Yes.
Definitely.
Yes. What a world in which we live. The good news is that it will soon all be over. We of all people know, believe, and possess with utmost faith the knowledge that the Lord God Yehovah is soon to send his Son and our Lord Yeshua the Messiah and Saviour of the world back to this rebellious planet to usher in the kingdom of God in order to save humanity from itself and to rule the earth for an entire millennium, bringing that same humankind the very first worldwide peace and prosperity concerning which human beings for centuries have desperately longed. Make no mistake, Christ, as he arrives on this blue sphere, will literally destroy those who destroy the earth, Revelation 11:18. And those men and those women who are united together and in policy alignment for world depopulation through a wide variety of means at their disposal, including, as Bill Gates has openly admitted, through the use of vaccination programs, will be among the very first to be neutralized. Only then will the Lord Yeshua be entirely capable of restoring the earth to its original Edenic perfection. Back to Noah. This present age in which we live dates only back to Noah. It says so in 2 Peter 2:5. So this present evil age starts with Noah. He is told by God to build an ark. God says, go and build a ship. He says, what's a ship? What's an ark? It's a huge vessel, not a large house full of animals, as depicted in so many religious children's books. Most of us don't give much thought about this demand. But what would Noah have had to know firsthand about building such an awesome craft, measuring in all 229,500 square feet? That's massive! Noah would have had to possess an enormous amount of knowledge of mathematics, shipbuilding, and other technologies that would rival 21st century know-how. Many Bible scholars have been astonished at the precision that was involved in the creation of the ark. Modern recreations of this enormous vessel speak volumes as to the remarkable academic elements that produced it. It was certainly anything but a crudely fashioned floating device. Israel Bible Center turns around and sends a thing to me the other day, and it's, you know, all it was a large round vessel that could bob up and down on water. No, get real. And they say, we want you to join us. Not in your life. You come here. Come to this place. Come and hear the word of God. Not dribble. The ark's length to breadth ratio of 6 to 1, at 300 cubits to 50, is, in the view of modern shipmakers, almost as perfect as can be desired in such a creation of a water floating vessel. Ships never came as close to the perfection of the ark until the mid-19th century, when I.K. Brunel gave the world the ocean liner, the Great Britain. It was in the year 1844, and Great Britain's proportions were identical to those of Noah's ark, 322 by 51 by 32.5 feet.
Mm. Massive!
Mm. René Neuerbergen, I've mentioned it before, says, Noah's ship ranks as the first of its kind. Brunel had several thousand years of shipbuilding expertise to rely on, but all the accumulated knowledge he could draw from did not give him a better ratio than that of the ark. The truth of the matter is that Noah created this enormous vessel because he was entirely capable of doing so. And I read that and I thought, yeah, of course he did. He had all this knowledge from the past.
Mm, but God had instructed him too.
Exactly. Mm. So God chose Noah not just for what may have been his good looks and likely reliable devotion and faith, but because Noah had access to a technology that had reached its awesome summit. The fact is, human civilization had reached a peak of technological brilliance paralleled only by ours today, as strange as this reality may be to some who hear this lecture. The truth is that technologically, we were already where we are today 4,000 to 6,000 ideal years ago. This in real terms amounts to about 12,000 plus actual years ago. So God told Noah well in advance he was about to send a major catastrophic deluge of water upon and over the planet, and he was to build a boat large enough to accommodate the designated creatures that Yehovah would send to him for the survival of his wild kingdom. Suffice to say, Noah acted immediately in faith, because the inspired record states in Hebrews 11:7, because he feared Yehovah. Now, reverential respect, yeah, all right, I can go along with that. No, it was more, you're going to do this? I'm terrified of you. And he did it. He acted in faith, believing and fearing God. Mm. And if I got a command like that, I'd be terrified as well.
And he didn't know what rain was back then.
That's exactly right. There was a mist that rose. Remember that? Yeah. So again, I ask the question, what was our world like back in the days of Noah? The question remains unanswered. We've already discussed the massive increase in the population of Earth. Now consider this fact of cosmic history. A thick and formidable ring of ice surrounded the planet as revealed in the book of Job. I've talked about this before. The Hebrew details it as a swaddling cloth, a belt or band, which surrounded the planet and cast an enormous shadow as the planet revolved on its axis. The Hebrew for the ice ring is Arafel. Genesis mentions it as the waters that were above the firmament in Genesis 1, verse 6 and 7. And ice, of course, is just a form of solid water. Solid form of water. There are other planets in our solar system that have rings of ice surrounding them. Saturn, Neptune, Uranus, Jupiter. Astronomy magazine confirms the fact that all the planets in our solar system may very likely have once been ringed with ice. The biblical revelation informs us our planet had a mass of water high above the stratosphere at the beginning of creation week in Genesis 1 verse 7. Some of this original ice field remains caught in gravitational orbit above the Earth even now. This shattered field that collapsed on the days of Noah continues to circle the Earth and to have occasional devastating impact as great pieces fall. When floating ice blocks crash to Earth, they are usually of a large size, which indicate that originally they would have been of an enormous magnitude to survive the fiery impact of the Van Allen Belt. The Van Allen Belt is right around our planet, some many miles out, but as asteroids come through, they are reduced in size. As comets come through, they're reduced in size. It burns up. Even they've got where there are breaks in the Van Allen Belt when they're sending spacecraft out into space and back. They've got to have it technologically measured perfectly so that they don't burn up in the Van Allen belts.
That was that movie, the black girls when did the math.
Yes, that's right. The three black women. Yes. There are cases of record of blocks of ice falling from the sky, smashing entire motor vehicles, leaving gaping holes in the roofs of homes. In a well-documented case in England, a lady walked to her clothesline to put the washing out when a massive explosion caused her to reel about in her tracks. A 40-foot iceberg from the heavens had demolished her home. How would you be? Putting the last singlet on the line. Where's my house?
Explain that to the insurance company.
Exactly. Scientists are at a loss to explain these incidents of falling icebergs, and they recognise that only a few are linked in any way to aircraft. It's on record that in the days of Charlemagne, a huge block of ice, 15 foot long, 6 feet wide, 11 feet thick, fell to earth in one giant mass, well before the invention of aircraft. At Ord in Scotland in 1849, an ice block fell to earth with a circumference of more than 18 feet. And so on it goes. The ice is left over from the waters that were above the earth, as recorded in Genesis. There's no doubt the earth was deluged in the days of Noah by virtue of waters bursting through the planet's crust and also crashing down from the heavens. It would have been horrendous. In Job 38, we read of the destruction of a wicked humankind. I won't turn there, running out of time. You can look it up in Job 38. An event which therefore had to have occurred after Adam's creation and prior to the time of Job, obviously as this record is included in his scroll, by water. Job 38, verse 8. God goes on to describe a thick darkness associated with the planet as a swaddling band surrounding the globe, in verse 9. So we see it cast an enormous, threatening shadow of darkness across the face of the earth, at least on occasion as the planet revolved on its axis every 24 hours. Longy's commentary describes it as a kind of flowing or floating darkness having some kind of black visibility. The late Dr. Ernest L. Martin, himself a meteorologist in his own right, comments with some speculation on the inclusion of this information in the before-mentioned commentary. He writes, "The mass of whatever it was appeared as a swath of intense darkness, looks like a swaddling band, that was located over the oceans, and its blackness, or perhaps its shadow, was clearly visible to people on Earth. The scholars who wrote the commentary did not know what was being described by this account in the book of Job. They felt compelled to transliterate the Hebrew that indicated an intensely dark band. They simply rendered it the dark Arafel for its swaddling band. The light of the sun, moon and stars could not penetrate through its mass simply because Job said that it presented the aspect of a black band located above the earth. In some way it was associated with water. It was some kind of flowing or floating darkness which had to do with the dropping of liquid by some kind of distillation process. This would be the meaning if one is allowed to wring out of it every bit of meaning of the word Arafel." Unquote. So it seems clear that the Arafel was a huge ice ring that circled high above the earth and which abruptly broke into pieces, possibly as a result of a meteor or asteroid strike that plunged earthward, corresponding well with the Mosaic account of the windows of heaven opened at the time of the Noahian deluge. The word for windows in that case is floodgates. The Bible tells us that a total of 276 inches of rainfall, 15 cubits of water, fell to earth, Genesis 7, verse 20. This means the ocean level was raised by 23 feet.
Wow.
But when we take into account the runoff, the oceans would have risen disastrously to approximately 30 feet. Now, that's what they're predicting about today, about 30 feet of water rising. Well, it's not going to happen, because God said he's never going to subject the earth to a major flood.
That's right.
So this epoch, which culminated in the catastrophic flood of Noah, could be called the Adamic Age. All ancient myths pertaining to this period speak of 10 world rulers. It has been suggested that the glory of Atlantis belonged to this Olam, and this may well be the case, for Atlantis sank. The Genesis tradition that the ancient pre-flood world was ruled by 10 patriarchs of noble stature and marvellous power parallels that of the mythologies of Atlantis, which claim that 10 god kings, demigods, ruled the ancient continent before disaster struck. The Sibylline oracles relate to 10 ages from creation to the deluge. The Chinese classics tell of 10 emperors who shared the divine nature. The Phoenicians refer to 10 patriarchal figures. The Hindus talk of 10 Pitris or fathers. The king lists of Egypt and Chaldea each claim 10 antediluvian rulers. When even a casual observer begins to study the ancient writings from all over the earth, and in particular the scriptures of the pagan world, One is singularly astonished at the remarkable similarities between them and the contents of the Hebrew and Messianic scriptures. For decades, the world has been moving slowly but steadily toward a world government. We shall see it eventuate with our very own eyes. God has left us significant prophetic indicators of the emergence of the final world kingdom so that his people will not be caught off guard concerning the end of days and the advent of Mashiach. The Mayan Popol Vuh, which I have quoted in past lectures in this series on faith, says, quote, that lands of the ten regions were shaken and torn asunder, and the cities with their millions of inhabitants sank beneath the sea. Cities with their millions of inhabitants. Ancient Sanskrit texts speak of mammoth cities with 60 million inhabitants being destroyed in one night. Men were almost wiped off the face of the planet. Just as there were ten regions in the age of Atlantis when the world came to an end, so there will be ten divisions of a world federal state ripe for an asteroid destruction when the end of days dawns. We're there. We're right at the point of the end of days emerging. We're in the end of the age, but not yet in the end of days. But I can see it coming. So now, in conclusion, we must return to our question about genetic atavism. Yes, I did get back there. All that was an aside. Why do we today possess gills in utero and sometimes as a newborn child? As difficult as it may well seem to some, God created Adam and Eve in an environment that was not as it is today. You won't hear this anywhere else, incidentally. You'll hear it here. Adam and Eve lived and breathed in a unique atmosphere that was extremely watery. As such, they had to have been created with lungs as well as gills. All living creatures would have possessed lungs and gills. We have established this already, as bizarre as it seems, for early embryos possessed gills as we today all have gills when we are in the womb. They are vestigial remnants of our ancestors' physical biological equipment, even though they are undeveloped and non-functional. But they were once well-developed and entirely functional. Wow. The earth at the dawn of time possessed a thick, oxygenated atmosphere that was very, very watery. We were all surrounded by water, by vapour, by something Genesis speaks of as a mist. Notice it now. Go back to Genesis 2. Have a look at verse 5 and 6 again. While you're turning there, I'll refresh myself with some water.
It'd be spurting out the side. But it was no fountain of youth.
I'm going to choke then.
Oh, stop.
Oh, you're hilarious.
I missed it. Your girl is watching.
Oh. At the creation, we read, Yehovah caused, God had not caused it to rain on the earth, but a mist went up from the earth and watered the whole face of the ground. The Hebrew for mist is ed, transliterated from Hebrew, ed. But it doesn't mean a mist as such. This is why some translators or revisionists in their versions of the text prefer to use fog, vapour, stream, spring, water, heavy dew, underground water would come up, etc. One commentary assures us of the following. The Hebrew, it says, is of somewhat doubtful meaning, because outside of this text it occurs only in Job 36, verse 27. Scholars have compared it with the Assyrian Idu, flood, and applied this meaning to two biblical passages where it occurs. But the word flood does not fit the context of either of these texts, whereas the word mist or vapour makes good sense in both instances. Ancient translations usually rendered the word spring, which rendering reveals they did not understand it. The improbability that one spring could have watered the earth plainly shows that spring cannot be the right translation of ed. Mist seems to be the best translation, and in this instance, we may think of mist as synonymous with dew. Watery dew, mist, fog, surrounding all life on earth, so thick that human beings needed gills at the very beginning of creation may stagger the imagination. But it appears to be the only answer to the reality of vestigial remnants in utero and in newborns that have puzzled critical scientific theorists as to serious explanation. The truth is that we were living, breathing, and moving our entire lives as an antediluvian species in a watery mist environment that enriched all the plant life of our planet as described in Genesis 2 and 3. With the destruction of the planet by water, and with the dawn of a new creation as Noah stepped off the ark into an entirely brilliant new atmosphere, rendered gills as no longer necessary for either humankind or animal life. Yet even today, here and there, a form of wildlife creature, either well known or as an entirely new or unknown species, will make its appearance replete with gills as well as lungs. In our next lecture, we shall examine 7 facts about Noah's faith. Are there any questions on any of this that I have shared with you laboriously today? Silence greets me, and I'm quite happy with that.